Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Andre Cohen, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, and welcome to AM Horizons Training Group. This is our weekly show, so we thank you for joining in with us, and you can catch us here or you can catch us online. And we're talking about things that matter most to each of us. And so as a high school educator, former high school educator, 8 years in the classroom, and as a camp counselor and working with young people, there are a number of things that I've learned about the world and about how to work with young people. And so I try to share some of those things that I've learned, because going into the classroom, oftentimes, teachers and adults think they know everything. And I have to say that it was a humbling experience for me to go into the classroom and have to relearn things that my students were trying to teach me. And so I'm going to share some of those things with you today. And today I want to talk a little bit about this concept of masculinity and how it's become this, that there seems to be, masculinity has seems to be usurped or synonymous with violence. And so I want to talk about, how do we deconstruct that violence? How do we help people who have been engaged in forms and acts of violence, and how we move to the next level of encouraging men and boys in support of helping women, because men's violence is not just enacted on women, but the major victims of men's violence are other men. So we want to talk about that today, and I have a guest on today that we will we'll sit down and chat with about some of these issues, and so I look forward to having that conversation. Just over the last week, in terms of world news, 2 individuals that have been pretty impactful in my life passed away. One is obviously Steve Jobs. People really revere him and the work that he's done with Apple, and how he's changed the way we communicate and all of those things. There was also a professor that passed away. His name was Derek Bell. And I don't know if you've read any of his books, but I have to say my mentors did a really good job. So Leon Sharp, you did a great job with me, because they they shared with me his book, Mary Ferguson and Leon Sharp and Aaliyah Mubarak Thorpe. We all worked on a project together, Suzanne too, and they got me connected with Derek Bell's work, and he wrote a book of short stories called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, and it really transformed how I was able to think about race and diversity. And so I would encourage, and maybe we'll do a chapter on his book on an upcoming show, but I really wanted to encourage each of you out there, if you're interested in diversity work, you have to get his pieces, because he speaks with a clarity and a conscience that we oftentimes don't hear in the racial dialogue. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get to our topic for the day. And I'm going to have Ed come on the line and tell us a little bit about himself and his organization, and then we'll start chewing on our primary topic for today. So, Ed, I'm going to unmute you, and if you could just introduce yourself and your organization and what you're about, we're interested.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Andre. My name is Ed Heisler, and I'm a prevention specialist with the Minnesota Mend Action Network. and we're an alliance to prevent sexual and domestic violence. And our primary work involves engaging men in being partners with women in the work to end sexual and domestic violence. And we do that through work that we call primary prevention, which is a public health model for thinking about how you change the social norms and the belief systems that support so much violence against women in the first place.
Great, great, great. So, okay, so, like, I'm familiar with people like Paul Kibble or Jackson Katz. Are there other notable men who are in this work?
Yes, there's an excellent kind of core of men who have been involved in the work, some of which have been involved from the very beginning of kind of the battered women's movements in their respective areas. In fact, one of the men that I work with in the Minnesota Men's Action Network's name is Chuck Derry, and he's been doing the work since about 1983, and speaks all over the country. We've worked with a man named Joe Ehrman, who's actually a former All-Pro NFL football player, and now he's been named the most important coach in America. He speaks all across the country. There's actually too many to try to name who all the key men in the work are, but there's a great group of men who are involved in this work.
Yeah. So why do you think? I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me, and probably to some of our listeners, but some folks would say, well, you know, domestic violence is a women's issue, and it's been a women's issue. Why would men want to be involved? And how would you respond to that?
Well, that's a great question, and it's very true that when I give presentations, a lot of times audiences are coming from a perspective that this is a women's issue. You can see that reflected in who shows up to the presentations oftentimes. It'll be a vast majority of women unless you use specific strategies to try to get men to show up. And I think that there's some really, it makes a lot of sense that that would be the case. We know that statistically about one in every three women will experience sexual or domestic violence at some point in their life. And so it's women who have been dealing with the incredibly harsh reality that comes with the violence that they've been experiencing at the hands of primarily men. The majority of sexual and domestic violence is perpetrated by men. And so women really took responsibility for caring for women who were going through this sort of violence, as well as for trying to figure out how you prevent this violence from happening. But as the movement moves along, it's clear that, you know, when you have a situation where the majority of the violence is being perpetrated by men, and we're all connected to our mothers, our wives, our girlfriends, our sisters, our friends, that pretty soon it becomes pretty clear that this actually is as much a men's issue, if not more, than it is a women's issue, because men are really at the core of taking responsibility for the violence that does occur, and can play a huge role, have a great opportunity and responsibility, I think, to figure out how to stop it with their fellow men.
Yeah. Is it, do you think, you know, a lot of times when I'm engaged in these conversations, there are women who are either can feel upset or intimidated by the fact that men are now engaging in this conversation, and in some ways some of the language that has been used, particularly in my conversation, is that that women feel discounted because they've been in the struggle for so long, and now men are coming in getting high exposure. Do you find that sometimes in your presentations, or are women pretty accepting of any help that they get in terms of fighting and helping to change paradigms?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, in my experience, and I talk to a lot of other men in the work as well, and it's a pretty strong theme that women are very, very accepting and supportive of men who are ready to get down and do the work with them as partners. that's been my experience. I've learned almost everything that I know in this work from women and have been kind of helped and guided and supported all along the way. What is tricky about it, though, is that there is a lot of privilege that comes from being a man alone. So even very early in my work, I had the experience of being able to walk into certain audiences or audiences that included men and immediately having more credibility than the women that I was co-facilitating with or the women who had tried to do presentations with this audience in the past. I remember there was immediately more interest in having me come and speak because the perception was that I probably had something interesting and important to say, whereas there was a lot of ideas attached to who the women were that would come and speak about this topic. So that can be frustrating. The other thing that's true is that, I think that a very smart concern that a lot of women in the work have is when men come, what are they going to do? There's been 30 plus years of work that's gone into building the battered women's movement in particular. And so sometimes what can happen is men can come in, they can volunteer, they can show up to meetings, and all of a sudden they've got the answers and they're taking over the whole process. And that can be really damaging. Sometimes it can be dangerous to the people who are experiencing the violence. And so there's this vast spectrum of experiences that women can have in working with men in this work. And my experience says that they are more than welcoming. They've been asking their brothers and their sons and their husbands to come and help ever since this started. And so if you're willing to come to the table and be a partner with them, you're gonna have a great group to work with.
So tell me more about the Men's Action Network. Like, what is it that you're gathering men to do, and how are you helping to facilitate change in how men's relationships with women become better?
Right. Well, we're kind of an interesting organization because, our work focuses on preventing sexual and domestic violence, and we've got a variety of ways that we do that. The Men's Action Network actually was developed out of a project with the Minnesota Department of Health. There was an assessment that Frank Jewell and Chuck Derry, both of Minnesota, did to see what sort of work men were doing around the country and then what sort of primary prevention work in particular men were doing. And so that means what sort of work were men doing beyond just kind of the regular educational programming to try to institute organizational practices, policies, things like this that would reshape the environment so that sexual and domestic violence wasn't so likely. And what they found was that in the area of primary prevention, men's work was quite limited. So that's the gap that the Minnesota Men's Action Network aimed to fill. Currently, we still receive funding through the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Justice, and we have some VAWA money as well. Our work centers around, we do work in communities, organizing men to be a part of the prevention process in communities across the state of Minnesota, as well as on campuses. So we kind of have those two community focuses. Within that, we do everything from having men's forums where we specifically target men in the community to come to a presentation and help get the conversation started about what they could do to prevent sexual and domestic violence. We provide technical support then to those men to help them form their strategies and connect with local advocacy organizations and women who are doing the work. So that's a big piece of what we do, both on campuses and in communities. The other big part of our work is we've been developing now for some time primary prevention strategies, and they've been developing, and we're getting to a point where we can recommend certain strategies to certain communities when they contact us. So we'll be releasing a project pretty soon called the Mending Project, where men can take responsibility in their community for repairing the harm done by domestic and sexual violence. And it's kind of a pro bono service plan. It's kind of this all-inclusive package that helps men gather donations and think about the things that a woman who's trying to leave an abusive relationship or a woman who's experienced a sexual assault, what are some of the goods and services that they might need? It's a process of collecting those, educating people about why this is important, how to maintain confidentiality and safety, all that kind of stuff, and help repair some of that harm. We've got athletic initiatives. We're actually working with Anoka County on those to think about how we are participating in raising
coaching men. Is that the Coaching Boys Into Men project?
It is the Coaching Boys Into Men project, and that's Donna McDonald has been doing a lot of work on that specifically in Anoka. We have a similar project that we're working on in Duluth and in some other communities as well. And we have strategies for campuses around how they create party environments and dorm environments, campus life environments that are safer and more respectful and more fun for women as well. So it's a little snapshot of what we do, but it's we have a kind of a broad variety of strategies that we use with men in communities.
Yeah, those seem pretty comprehensive in terms of the services that you offer and the way that you do some outreach and training and basic kind of prevention and knowledge about those things. I find it interesting that, and it's so funny because I've listened to women and I hear women talk about sexism and I hear them talk about domestic violence and that kind of stuff, but I typically have not really heard men sit down and talk with other men about sexism or domestic violence or men's violence even towards each other. I mean, it kind of has become a something that we know, but we never talk about. And so, how do you engage men to actually talk about these things that we, you know, for whatever reason our culture says we don't talk about?
Right. Well, you know, that's a real, you know, one of the norms that really supports sexual and domestic violence is the silence and the secrecy and the shame that surrounds it just in general. But I think that in particular for men, because it's been seen as a women's issue, we really haven't had to talk about it with one another. And so that silence has been maintained. A part of what we try to do is speak to the importance of how we're raising our children, particularly our young boys. And so if you want to look at breaking what we call an endemic reality of 1 in 3 women experiencing the sexual and domestic violence, and of course that includes our daughters and our sisters and those people, it's necessary that we think about what messages we're giving our young boys, what environments we're creating for them, what sort of mm-hmm. culture we're steeping them in, and how we help them process and analyze that. So speaking to that need, to how are we going to raise our young boys so that they can have happy, healthy, safe, fulfilling relationships in the future. One thing that we always talk about is that boys aren't raised. Boys are never born violent. You don't, when you think about the little 2-year-olds in your life, you know, those little boys are not, you know, controlling, coercive, violent
right.
people. They show love and affection and caring. And so yeah. something is happening through our environment and our culture to create so much violence. So we speak to the need to address that. I think that that the other thing that we work very hard to do is to convey the scope of the problem and then try to build empathy around the issue as well. So our message commonly is that men have both the opportunity and the responsibility to make a difference when it comes to sexual and domestic violence. Because when you're silent on the issue and you aren't doing anything, it actually supports what is normal, and that's unfortunately very high levels of violence and dominance against women.
Yeah, we were. I was just doing a session the other day, and we were having a conversation about the Madonna motif that women typically have to walk or balance. And so part of that Madonna is you know, the Virgin Mary, the Mother of Christ, that kind of thing, as well as the pop culture hit of the 80s. That Madonna, you know, like a virgin and being, you know, sexually available to men and striking that balance. Do you think that you know, in our society, it definitely appears that everything is being hypersexualized. Seeing 7-year-old girls' swimming suits that were padded. I think American Apparel came out with a line of padded bikini suits for 7-year-old girls, and we see these pageants and all this kind of stuff. What role do you think, or how do we combat the hypersexualization of all children, but particularly it appears that girls are being hyperly sexualized? So how do we as men stand up and combat that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I kind of think about it in two separate ways. Just to clarify what you're saying, I agree completely, and some of our presentations will show. We've cut out from three different magazines. We had an intern at one point who cut out all the pictures of men that she could find and all the pictures of women that she could find. And the pictures of women were, by and large, stripped down, very exposed, very sexualized. The pictures of men, the first thing that people oftentimes say about them is, they look mean and they're wearing clothes.
Right.
And so you've got these normalized ways that men and women are portrayed, and it says stuff about what we value about men and women as well. I think that as far as how you approach it, there's kind of two parts. One, when we think about our primary prevention strategies, you can try to reshape some of the images and messages that the media and our pop culture, et cetera, is putting out there. And so you can have strategies when the padded bikinis come out and things like this of, you know, having the letter writing campaigns, contacting the people who are selling, you know, if Walmart or Target or any of those folks are selling these products, you work to undercut the flow of money that's being received due to those products. And so very slowly you can try to work to make it so that, you know, when products that are hypersexualizing young women are showing up, that there's a response that's making it, you know, not as desirable to release those kinds of products. That's slow work, and your goal usually is to get to a point where you can get companies or somebody in the system that's producing those products to make a policy that puts some boundaries on what sort of products they're actually going to release. The other reality to this is that these products and this hypersexualized kind of soup that we're all existing in isn't going to go away overnight. And so there's also this very important piece about helping our young men and women to understand, think critically about what exists around them. And that's difficult work. But one of the things that I liked when Joe Ehrman was working with us on our athletic initiative was that he said that he wants to use football, in his case, to raise young men who have empathy, caring, and value service to others. And I was thinking about, you know, that very kind of specific mission that Joe Ehrman has. And, you know, if people in our young boys' lives are thinking about shaping boys in that sort of positive light, I think that that starts to touch on the ability to critically think about and analyze and interact with this hypersexualized environment that we have. Because if you're seeing women through a lens that says, you know, that they're important, that they have as much value as men, that they're equal, that their thoughts are to be valued, that when they're hurting, that's something where you want to provide care rather than take advantage of, et cetera, then I think that's another piece that's moving towards helping boys kind of reconstruct the way that they exist in this environment. And the same sort of process can be true for women as well.
Yeah, and the process just seems really. I can see how it can be really confusing for boys and men, because I think about the messages that I was sent as a boy. You know, my uncles would ask me how many girlfriends that I have, as if, you know, at age 12, I'm supposed to have a harem. You know, so you have that kind of pressure. And then at the same time, anything that was outside of the norm of being a boy was considered being a girl, and girls were bad. And so the most precious relationships that I've had in my life were with women. You know, my mother, my grandmother, and these were women that I loved and adored. But at the same time, I was taught that there were aspects of them that I was supposed to hate and detest if I was going to be a man. And so, you know, I also think to add to, you know, what you were saying, it's important to bring that to light in boys and men's lives, that there are these messages that are convoluted, that are, you know, that are sometimes even counterproductive to being a healthy individual, that the media plays out for us, that we'll see on the internet, and realizing that, and it's so funny, when I taught high school, a number of the boys would, you know, they would call it knacking on a girl or whatever. And I said, what would you do if somebody did that to your mother? Or what would you do if somebody did that to your little sister? And they would get quite an attitude, you know, and that's intolerable. For, you know, nobody's going to do that to my sister. But when I brought to light that the girl that they were trying to do that to is somebody's sister, or is somebody's daughter, or could be someone's mother, how does that change? And for whatever reason, I always found it interesting that they really hadn't given it much thought. You know, that their behavior had become so automatic that thinking of, you know, a woman as a mother or a sister or a daughter, someone's daughter, hadn't really crossed their mind. And so I thought that was.
Well, and it makes me think, you're right, that the cultural messages, the messages that young boys receive about what it means to be a man and what it means to be in relationship, any kind of relationship with women, is both kind of frightening, and it can just seem overwhelming. If you think about the script that plays out over and over in front of us on the TV or on the radio or within groups of friends, et cetera, you know, it's not a scene that's going to be particularly beneficial to women. I think that one thing that is positive about it when it starts to feel overwhelming is that there is a lot going on that is kind of reshaping and helping men to become a part of the solution here. And I think about, I mean, this conversation in the first place, the conversation between two men talking about the importance of ending sexism and helping young boys become healthy partners, I mean, and ending violence against women, that is something that doesn't follow the script very well, the common script in society. And when you think about having, you know, a ever-growing number of coaches and teachers and religious leaders and parents who are thinking through the lens of, you know, it's not enough just to remain silent or to say, you know, you gotta respect your mom. I have to help my young man. You know, understand how to value the dignity of everyone and be a good partner and be nonviolent, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of hope in that I can see in our work how the impact touches individual lives on a very frequent basis. So that's very positive.
So Ed, we have about a minute or so. Can you tell us how we can get in contact with you, or in that minute, how do we engage in the Men's Action Network?
Sure. Well, you can visit our website, which is www.menaspeacemakers.org, and then /MinMan. That'll take you to our specific website. If you have any trouble or that got a little too long, you can just go to the Men as Peacemakers website, www.menaspeacemakers.org, and there's a link to the Minnesota Men's Action Network on the bottom right-hand corner, and that has a lot of information. Otherwise, you can get in contact with me directly at ed@menaspeacemakers.org. www.thebrainfeedingclinic.org, and I'd be happy to connect you with whatever you're interested in as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Ed. And we definitely will get offline and talk about some things and build our collaboration. And so, again, I want to thank you for going out there and making this stuff work. And for the audience out there, I want to thank you today for sitting and listening with us. And until next time, this is Andre Cohen, and I'll see you in cyberspace. Have a great day.
GEICO presents Sharing versus Oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. GEICO has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.